Well, we're sitting in this beautifully decorated and colour coordinated house in sort of muted pinks and kind of dove colour, I suppose you'd call it. It's exceptionally tidy. The owner has
Kirsty Allsop, watch out. Relocation will be knocking on your door.
Shut up.
Welcome to another instalment of the Clem & M podcast with me, Clemmy Stewart.
And me, Emma Kell.
Think of this as two passionate teachers talking over a coffee or a tea, unpicking issues in education in the broadest sense of the term. What happens in school, what could happen in school, and what should happen in schools from people who no longer work in schools.
From all sorts of sectors, what their school experiences taught them about life and what they would teach schools if they had the chance.
Every time I speak to somebody and they find out I'm a head teacher, the first thing they do is tell me about their experiences at school. It's something that clearly people enjoy talking about.
Is because that a bit like being a doctor, though, when someone starts
possibly
showing
you their gammy ear?
Yeah.
But I think it's really important. It makes me reflect as a head and as a teacher. You know, what in 20 years' time, what will my kids be saying to somebody at a dinner party about their time with me? And hopefully it'll be a positive. And in fact, that leads beautifully onto who we're joining today. One of your ex-students, Dr. Kell.
Yes, so this is a young lady called Nilufar Hidayat. She's an extremely successful documentary maker. Her accolades include Newsround, Traffickers and Channel 4 News. And we are delighted to be in her minimalist house today to speak to her.
So Nilufar, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you.
Obviously, I know you far less well than Emma does. Emma was your teacher.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited to hear all about what that looked
and
like.
And if I accidentally, through this, just call you Miss, can you just forgive me?
Nilufar, can we just clarify, how old are you?
I'm 32.
You're 32, right, okay. So yes, you don't need to call me Miss. I know you slipped back into that one.
You're still going to be Miss.
On a regular basis.
You are still going to be Miss the whole way through.
So for me, I suppose Nilufar embodies a period in my career, which was just nuts. It was insane. It was the most challenging, difficult. I got used to get sworn at on a regular basis.
By Nilufar.
Well, we'll get onto that later.
Dear listener,
Nilufar. It embodies, as I was saying, the most challenging but the most joyful time of my career. And I'd done about 14 months in a very nice school in South Gloucestershire. And I thought, right, I tried teaching, I'll do something else now. It's all right, you know, do something else. And then I landed at this school in Haverstock, in Camden, Haverstock School, with this barbed wire over the fences. And I walked in, I was the only applicant for the job. And I remember the person who interviewed me saying, you know, you seem like, you know, quite, you've been teaching in South Gloucestershire, you've come from Buckinghamshire, are you sure this is what you want? And then I remember she said to me, well, you seem quite ordinary, so you might be okay. Walked into this school and I have never worked or played so hard in my life. And those years, we were the bottom of the league table in Camden. And I'm going to give him a name check now, led by the amazing Mr. John Dowd.
Woo!
Woo! All of those years, he was incredible, most incredible head teacher. I learned so much from him. Bottom of the league table, and quite proudly so.
Yeah.
And we did want to improve, and we did improve. We improved so much in those 5 years you were there. So I started in 2002 when you would have been around 12.
Yes. Wow, I was once 12.
You were once 12,
yeah.
And I was your form tutor.
Yes,
and
you
then
were.
I taught you German.
No, you forced me to learn German.
No, you learned lovely German.
And you enjoyed it.
I did enjoy it. Well. I enjoyed German.
She did. And the other thing, I've been writing a lot recently for young teachers about dealing with parents. And I had my memory in my head when I was thinking about terrifying parents was your lovely mum.
She's going to love hearing that.
You're going to need to enjoy that.
Who I met when I was infinitely younger than you are now, and I remember quaking in front of this formidable woman who I came.
Can you imagine her being your mother? Okay, I have to live with that, and I feel it too.
And I came to adore her, and she came to embody how much it meant for a parent and a teacher. Because actually, dear listeners, Nilufar wasn't perfect all the time. So Nilufar, knowing that actually her mum and her teacher were in cahoots and regular telephone contact, fact. And she couldn't breathe without permission. So I learned as much from Nalufa and her cohort as she did from me.
This is actually an opportunity for me to defend myself. This is why I'm here, guys. I'm not here for any other reason than to defend my behaviour.
This is why you've made the time to be
this
here.
This is why we're doing this. No, all of that is absolutely true, yeah. And I have to say, from my perspective, as... as tumultuous and crazy as it was for you to come from a small town to London to one of, like, we had only just got rid of our stabbing problem. Like, that's not even a joke. Like, we had had a serious issue with, like, stabbings and drug dealings at Haverstock only a few years before you arrived.
But we still did. We did, but
within the school premises, like, we had this huge problem of it. So when I arrived at Haverstock, it was because it was near where I lived. We didn't have many other choices. I didn't pass the test for the local, you know, good girls school, Camden School for Girls. I didn't pass that test. I was too far away and all this. So I came to Haverstock, I remember, as a 12-year-old kid with absolutely no expectations of anything being different in my life than they were in the people that I was growing up with in my estate, because that's where I lived. So I was just like, I go here for 5 years and then I go and get a job. And then and that's just my world. That was my expectations. Suffice it to say, that's not what happened. And my schooling and my education and what that did for me as a young, malleable person is part of that. And, like, you just said that you worked really hard and we played really hard. That involved, like I learned to club with you. It's a thing. Like, we did. Like, you want, all right, I got all the receipts, Emma.
Are we talking about Berlin?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
We didn't know it was a gay club when we went in, and it opened some eyes. I do remember a young Somali lad standing outside saying, "I'm not going in there." And then by the end of the night, he's having a great time.
Isn't that teaching inclusivity and acceptance and diversity? I think therefore you were doing a fantastic
that
job.
Literally changed their lives.
Was there a risk assessment though?
It was a cafe.
I'm sorry, but that's just to say, like, we learnt way more than what we learnt in that classroom. Like, I did learn to say hello and chicken in German, but then I also learnt that my world, that I thought I was this little factory that existed in between my estate, the school, and the local supermarket, and that's the world that I was going to inhabit, was just not true. It's that there is more. And
what taught you that? What broadened that out for you?
So I think before we had Miss Kel, we had another teacher. Her approach to teaching before we got Emma was just a case of, like, I'm responsible for you between these hours. I will make sure you don't kill each other. And I will try and get you to go to chess club. Like, and if I don't, then that's just your choice. But I will tell you your options available. I don't think I felt like... I felt like she was part of a system that just existed to make sure that I'm safe and I get through the system.
Which wasn't always easy.
She was petulant, I think, at times. She was adversarial. Like, as a teacher, you know, for me, the best teaching experiences that I've ever had were not ones where my teacher was, like, talking down to me or telling me the rules. It was when they were explaining to me why it is not okay to use racial or homosexual or homophobic slurs in the class. Because trust me, the school that I went to, it was absolutely normal to say things like, "Oh my god, that's gay, that's so gay," you know. And that's just the view I had. So Emma comes in year eight. I think you came in year eight, so we just finished year seven with Miss Mehmed Begovic, and Emma comes in, and all of a sudden we all collectively as a class knew that some paradigm had shifted. It was different.
Emma, yeah, the paradigm shifter, the title of my next book.
It should be. I think so. And I think the way it translated over the years, you know, is we were having incredibly difficult conversations. You have to remember, like, 9/11 had just happened.
I remember 9/11 very clearly, and I was obviously in a very different type of school, as you know. And we were in the middle of a hockey match. So first example.
So you're, just to put this in perspective, you're pretty much the same age, you two,
aren't
you?
I'm 2 years older.
Right. So you two are far closer in age.
So we both experienced 9/11 as pupils. Right, and we were playing a hockey match against another local school, and the umpire just suddenly blew the whistle and said, you all need to get up to the TV room right now. And there was this whole sense of school stops, nothing matters anymore. We were sat next to kids from another school who were going, our rival school, who half an hour before, that mattered. It mattered that we beat them in this hockey match. And then we suddenly sat in the TV room and just watched what was happening unfold. And people were crying, people wondering where their parents were because they were living in New York. We were hugging kids that we'd never even met before. That the shift in the time, your understanding of that as a pupil was huge. What did that look like in your school?
Yeah, I mean, we were in the upper years by then, but imagine being a predominantly Muslim school going through that. Like most of my class was full of young, hot-headed, you know, teenage boys who after 9/11 happened were being told a narrative of who they were as young men, and the girls in my class, like I distinctly remember of the 15 or so girls, Emma, that I was close to at school after 9/11, almost all of them started to wear the hijab.
And why? Why was that?
Because all of a sudden we felt within the school environment that we had to wear our religion on our sleeves, that we had to band together as a community because we were facing such hostility in the media. And I was bullied quite a lot.
Right.
Because I'm Afghan. I was born in Kabul, Afghanistan, and you know, Bin Laden was my uncle and we were hiding the Taliban.
I remember those comments.
Yeah, and like to the point where I remember one lesson in a food tech lesson, like they started to throw chairs at me and I would get spat on and pushed down the stairs in the English staircase block, the math staircase block.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, but I'm not like...
This is post 9/11.
This is post 9/11.
At school?
Yeah, at school. Yeah, I live that. You know, so of course it was difficult to be, I was one of three Afghan kids in a school where we were predominantly Muslim, where we had like a group of sort of young white boys and with permission, I guess, from the other students to have a crack, to like say these like awful things. And I remember everyone just sat there and watched this tall boy throw a chair at me. And I was like, I'm on my own here and I am going to have to figure out how to defend myself because I can't, he's bigger than me, he's stronger than me. I have to find another way of dealing with this. And the reason I'm telling you the story and about what happened in 9/11 and what it was like to go to school after that is because what Emma taught us in terms of the extracurricular stuff, like the stuff that you're not responsible to teach us, that gave me the tools I needed to be able to defend myself with words, with how I conduct myself, with how I stand, with how proud I should be of who I am. And you can't, like, I don't know what lesson that fits into, but it's what I learned at school as well.
I suppose it's that hidden curriculum, isn't it, that a lot of schools talk about. And I think one of the biggest challenges, I just put myself in your shoes, to hear that as a teacher of something that was happening in my school, I'd find that incredibly hard to hear.
Actually, I never knew you were pushed down the stairs, and there's a part of me that actually finds that really upsetting. Because I'm actually feeling like, for all your lovely words, that we let you down. The duty of care to schools to keep you safe. You know, I remember saying that to you as a class. The most important thing is that you're safe. Yeah, all the rest, you know, the German verb tables can wait. And actually did anyone deal with that in school? Did you tell anyone?
No, so as it so you, like, okay, and yeah, it is a school's job to keep us safe, but you can't be in every nook and every cranny all the time.
Why didn't you ask for help, or why didn't you? I'm not, it sounds like I'm blaming you, I'm not at all.
No, please.
But why didn't you cry out for that help or that support as a Muslim girl in a school facing those sorts of challenges and those tensions? Why didn't you reach out?
Because
for help?
They would have wanted me to, because then it feeds into a system, and then they would get a warning or they'd get a verbal warning, and that's fine. Whereas my whole thing was, what I wanted them to understand was why this was wrong between two people.
Yeah.
Like, why this was wrong between us. The institution, the school system that we were in, of course, is the responsibility of us. But you waited for me to come down those math stairs in a tiny little corner for you to then, like, just, like, nudge at me, threaten to spit your gum at me, and then push me down the stairs. Like, you waited for that moment. I remember two male students that were in my class as well, two Asian boys, were there as well, and they sort of got involved, and I was just like, no, I got this. And I just turned to them and said to them, I can't remember the words that I said in that moment, but it was very much a sentiment of like, you could push me down the stairs all you want. The facts are facts. And your ignorance, the fact that you literally cannot get your head around the facts, is just going to mean that we're going to be doing this forever. You can bully me for as long as you want. I'm still going to be here and I'm still going to be this person.
And I think it, for me, listening to that, it's really hard to think that you were the one leading on that education. As I was saying to you earlier, I used to teach in Aldershot and I taught, it's an army garrison town, and I was there from 2010 to 2014 when parents were out doing active service in Afghanistan. And I had to teach Islam in year five. So our first lesson, you know, it would normally be, you know, the five pillars and an introduction. We would start our first time with extremism.
Wow.
And just get that whole conversation out of the way, because these children were, at the risk of generalising, they were white British children of squaddies in a military town, and some of the language and some of the terminology used to describe Afghanistani people was absolutely shocking. And, and certainly to me, I found it really difficult to listen to. So we would spend our first lesson getting it all out, getting rid of it. Well,
a bit like the sex education lesson where you say all the words for Willy.
Exactly like that. But instead of silly words for Willy, it was, you know, really horrendously racist terminology about people, and we would just get it out the way. And I was always mindful. I had Muslim children in the classroom. I had children whose dads, you know, one of whom had just lost a leg because he'd been blown up.
I can't imagine that.
And trying
that.
To manage that as a first lesson was pretty
extraordinary. Yeah, so it's almost like our experiences are two sides of a very, very connected coin. Like two sides of a very connected story, because I then, when I finished school, I went to university, and, you know, everyone's happy for you to be as different as physically bloody possible. But then I went into the real world and I realised that that narrative that the kids learn is a what kids learned at school and the way they were talking to me at school and the way they were talking in the school that you went to is a concentrated version of the wider conversation we were having as a society. It's just adults are too polite to say it out loud.
And frequently a reflection of the conversation they're having around the dinner table. And again, I'm not blaming parents at all, but children will parrot back what they hear.
Because it's too bloody advanced. Like the things that some of these kids were saying to me, like these, you know, 15, 16-year-old boys, just like, you don't know that word, you twat. You don't know what that word means. You heard that word or read that word somewhere. And remember, like, for my generation, for our generation, Clem, like, this was when the internet was just starting to happen.
Yeah,
so it can't have come from there.
Nope. So this wasn't coming from, like, racist people on YouTube or whatever. This was coming from something more closer to home. So it was dealing with all of that.
So interesting. And I think we're moving into another time now where, again, with the shifting political landscape and globalization, as we were talking about earlier, there's just this sense of people who are either reaching out and wanting to be part of that global village and conversation, or people who are becoming so insular within their echo chambers and their own firmly held beliefs that they're just not open to that challenge anymore. And I think some of the rhetoric you even see at Parliament level now is terrifying in terms of how people speak and the arguments they use to defend their own perspective is quite scary.
I'm quite glad you went down that road, actually, Nilufer, because I was obviously I know you well, but I was Googling you, and your Wikipedia, always the fount of all knowledge. ask your 10, honestly. But, you know, it's almost as if there's a quote from you which basically says, I came from war-torn Kabul to North London and everything was fine. And actually, it wasn't fine. And I've, of course, with 20 years gap, have this rose-tinted view of this. You know, we had the highest number of refugees of any school in Europe, didn't
we? That's right, yeah.
You know, and it was a school to be proud of. But it was actually a very difficult place to be. And it wasn't just the Islamophobia. There was the year when there was a boy in our group who was attacked. There were the Somali gangland killings. And actually, let's not sugarcoat this. My friend and one of your teachers from Haverstock, who came on many of our trips, has actually been to 6 funerals in the last 2 years
of
mainly young Somali men from Camden. Not all Somali. One young Turkish man who committed suicide in prison because his special needs hadn't been met.
All
of whom were students at our school, at Nilufer. So you know, I mean, it's
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. 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 I mean, and this is the next generation. I think, is the result of the huge cut in special needs funding over the last 6, 7, 8 years. And for my friend, you know, this is absolutely devastating. It's infuriating.
I mean, obviously, you don't have to look far to look at statistics around mental health in young, particularly men. Why do you think it's pertinent to Somali, Turkish? Is that just a coincidence or is there something more there, do you think?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, there's a whole... I don't know. I'm not going to pretend to give a clever answer to that.
Like, so I can't give you a top-down, like, systematic, like, macro view of it, but I can tell you, like, having gone to Havistock and being aware of the Somali gangs, but also the Bengali gangs in Drummond Street and also the Somers Town boys, like, for us, it wasn't just this one kind of like, well, the Somalian boys are killing each other. Mm. It's a black-on-black crime. It's a Somali-Somali crime and all this and all this and all this. For us, it was a case of like, these young boys are growing up with a narrative in our nation that is unimaginably toxic. And because when you're young, you think that, you know, you can solve this. Like, you've got that naivete that youth offers. That these young boys, and we were there. We were the girls, like, at the corners going, stop, or whatever else. They just felt like they were going to resolve it in the school once and for all. And that led to knife attacks. That I remember being outside once. I can't remember the exact context. But one of the local white boys... this was in sixth form, had seen a group of the Asian boys, predominantly Bengali boys, come out. And there was a scuffle and a knife was pulled out and one of the boys got, like, stabbed in the head. But, I mean, he was fine. But he was... And that was an average, like, lunchtime. And we still went to the chip shop and we got our chips and came back.
Because it becomes normalised.
But the thing is that that's
scary.
And I remember the footage of those young boys on the bus, going on the bus and stabbing someone coming down in Camden where we grew up and being associated with I think the point I'm trying to make was, for us, this national narrative was being fought in the school corridors. Mm. That's the reality of it. And we can try and say kids are kids or this was a predominantly Somalian kid issue. It isn't. Mm. The 15-year-old boys and girls take what we hear to heart, and we are so naive we think we can solve it. And for me, that naivety played out in a beautiful way, and I took the stuff that Emma was teaching me and about what gay rights were and that it's okay to be different and that you should celebrate all of that. I was taking that on board. A lot of the boys in my class were hearing the national narrative about they are villains and they're terrorists and that they will always be these things, and they were rejecting it in their own way. So it hurts me to hear that she's been to six funerals, and that's... But I'm not shocked, but it still hurts. I didn't know it was that
many. And she goes every time she goes to a funeral. Yes.
I can't imagine.
Oh, can we talk a bit about your mum and dad?
Yes.
I need to know about your mum. She sounds awesome.
Okay.
She sounds awesome. Tell
I'm her PR agent.
Love it.
So I'm very happy to talk my mum. My mum's called Petunia, my dad's called Nazir. And they met and fell in love in Bulgaria under the USSR re-education scheme, where they went to like a science, a university like exchange in Bulgaria. They met, they fell in love, they came back to Afghanistan, they got married, and then they were separated for a very long time because my dad was conscripted into the Afghan army and my mum was left with like me.
How old were you when he was conscripted into the army?
I wasn't born. She was pregnant.
Oh my gosh.
Yes. And I don't know if your listeners know much about the history of Afghanistan, but it's not a fun one.
Yeah.
It's very tumultuous. We've had civil war for 43 years. It's just gone on and on and on and on. And here we are after many different versions of occupation and reoccupation and deoccupation, I think, is where we are now. But we fled the war in Afghanistan, me and my mum. And I didn't really hang out with my dad till I was about six when we came to the UK. So our relationship is different to the rest of my siblings. But they are utterly in love.
Still now.
To this day. They are so cute. It's gross. As I sit here in my house, single and bitter, with my like can of
vegan coffee.
Yeah, with my oat coffee, just like sipping.
Vegan Fanta.
Oh, it's awful. And they're like going on a little date. Like, it's disgusting.
Oh, that's so cute.
So, how did they end up in Camden.
The Kabul to Camden story is just it's one that many people, whether you're from Afghanistan, Syria, China, Vietnam, in Iran, India, wherever, Bangladesh, wherever you might be, is the same story as all refugees. We were faced with a situation of stay and die or leave and maybe survive. And my mum took the odds. My dad, as I said, was able. He was in the army. We didn't know what was happening.
What was your understanding of that as a six-year-old? Did you understand the gravity?
All I know was my mum lost all her hair in Saudi Arabia because she was sad. She had, I later learned she got alopecia.
Stress.
Yeah. Stress, that's right. And that journey in itself of actually being, because we were trafficked here. I'm not going to sugarcoat it. We were trafficked. We were smuggled.
What was the journey?
The journey was horrific. It took 3 years. We went back and forth multiple times. So we would go to like, we would get halfway to Saudi and then there'd be a flight that we have to get on and they're like, this is not the right paperwork. And then we'd get like, this is like, we're either going to have to cut your arm off because this is Saudi,
yeah,
or go back and go back quickly because we will come and rage where we
know you're.
So they
knew full well what you were trying to do. 100%,
yeah. But there was this, I don't know, globally there's this, like in my career as a journalist, I've been doing it for 11 years. I've in fact made an entire series called The Traffickers. And my fascination with it came from how I got here. Mm. How do we traffic? How does the illicit dark world connect with like a nice little house in Walthamstow or schools in London? And it's simple that there's this like, there's this entire infrastructure put in place that we don't like to accept or talk about where people will move because it's natural for people to move from a place of hardship to a place of prosperity. If you want to stop that, you're going to have to get rid of humanity. We've been doing it for eons. Mm. So I don't feel bad for saying that I was trafficked or smuggled into this country. And anyone who stands there and can tell me it was the wrong thing for my mum to choose to do, I have a good argument against it. So we ended up on the shores of Britain, and I remember we were put up in like a B&B. We finally got smuggled in. The traffickers got better with their paperwork, thank God.
So how
God.
Did you, was it a ferry? Did you drive to Europe?
No, we were so lucky. So listen, this is before the days of asylum seekers. This is before the Red Tops got a hold of this kind of movement of people. I was never labelled an asylum seeker, which I was. I was always labelled as a refugee. My neighbours in the estate loved me. Whether they were white British or our neighbour was Bosnian, so she'd come from the Bosnian War. Mm. Our neighbours next door were Somalian. And I remember the neighbours right in front of me who had a dog, which I was obsessed with, Rex. They were white British. We all got this toxic narrative that I then grew up with didn't exist. And we just got on. I know it sounds mental, but we didn't.
Do you think
that's
because you were children?
No, I think it's because we hadn't been taught to hate yet.
Because I totally agree with that. And the school I was in before, the one I'm in now, was very, very diverse and very ethnic. And you would notice on the playground, the children genuinely didn't see that difference. They genuinely didn't. And yet something would then happen on the playground at pickup time where there would be a Nepalese group and there would be a Somali
Absolutely.
Group and there'd be an Eastern European group. And yeah. the parents created that sense of that sort of siloed
yeah.
approach.
Yeah.
Whereas the kids would genuinely just
play. And
I get
it, like from the parents' perspective, it's a fear thing. Like my mum would worry she'd embarrass me for saying something in her accent. Mm. My mum has a very thick accent and she would avoid talking to the, you know, British, the white British folk, because she'd be like, I'm going to embarrass my kid and I don't want to embarrass my kid. And I would be like, don't embarrass me. Shut up with your accent. Like, don't say it. Don't speak. That's what it was. So to go back to that idea of my parents were, if there were, let's say, three pillars to why I am the person I am and why I've had the career I've had, it would be probably my school with two teachers, an English teacher, Miss Knight, and a German teacher, Miss Kell, who were holding up that pillar. Mm-hmm. Then there would be mostly my mum, but my dad as well, for allowing me to be an independent Muslim woman. And then there would be like my best friend, Fatima, who, although we basically disagree on almost everything, to this day, I mean, I'm going to go kickboxing with her later. That was her idea. She wrote me in. And it's just, it's a case of like wanting those three pillars held me up and allowed me the space to kind of grow and be this person that I am today. I wasn't going to like the Latin class or going to like the swimming school and stuff. I was predominantly just I learned to be myself in that situation with those three pillars holding me up.
So we talked about school, we've talked about home, talking about Fatima. What, I'm intrigued by how you're different in every possible way.
Mate.
What does that look like?
We are different in almost every other way. And Fatima, I'm thinking very carefully of how I'm phrasing this as I as I sit and talk.
Just Fatima in case, will be listening.
In case you're listening. We're different because she's a devout practicing Muslim. Okay. And even though at school we were not, she adopted a more practicing stance sort of by the time we got into year 11, I'd say. She wears the hijab and the abaya, which are emblematic of her faith, and they present to the world her beliefs. I do not.
Did that ever cause any tension in your relationship?
It did when we were 19 once, and that was it.
Wow. Why? Yes. What happened at that point?
She had just started to wear the hijab. And I, for her 19th, or for one of our friends' 19th, somebody's 19th birthday, I had booked a trip to Paris. We were going to go to Paris for a day and come back before sunset when us Muslim women turn into bats or something. I don't know. I don't know what happens, but we had to be here before sundown. That was the thing. So we got like the 5 o'clock a.m. train to Paris. And we were going to spend, and that was my gift to one of our friends, or to Fatima, I think. And she, that day, chose to wear the hijab. And I was like, just take it off for the day.
Did you ever wear the hijab yourself?
No, never. No.
Did you ever think about it? Because I remember you said after 9/11 that a lot of, yeah, or most of the Muslim girls decided, yeah, to wear their religion.
I was an abject being pretty much all my life. Like, I've always been, I never ever fit in, and I choose not to. Like, I wouldn't let the British narrative of, like, you know, you have to be as free as utterly possible to be a liberal or a progressive feminist woman. And I didn't let the dogma of my faith, which I still believe in, alhamdulillah, I am Muslim, to tell me how I can conduct my being. So it's always been this uncomfortableness that I've, the space that I inhabit. And Fatima's always made it easy for me. And the way she does that is, we disagree quite a lot and we have these debates. And to just finish off that Paris story, I was just like, can you just take it off for today? Just take that thing off for today, just for the pictures, and then you can wear it tomorrow. And she was like, you're not understanding. This is me. This is who I am. And I've chosen today to come out and be who I am. You preach all this acceptance and tolerance, and you're telling me that I should take my hijab off. I was just like, but it's not who you are. I've known you all your life. This isn't who you are. Take it off. And she was just like, the fact that you're asking this is really, really hard for me now. And I took a moment back and I was like, who am I to tell her? Yeah. That she, yeah, can and cannot wear a hijab. And we, yeah, went, and I still have the photos, and she wore a white hijab with a red coat, and we went, we did Paris. It was great. We had a great time.
And it's never, ever been an issue since.
Never, never. And it never will be an issue. You know, when we go out or we go swimming, we go kickboxing, whatever we do in our day-to-day lives, like, she's never judged me for my choices, and I've never judged her. And that's just the most, I can't tell you the level of positivity, acceptance and tolerance that radiates from this woman.
I think that's so important. I saw a brilliant clip on social media yesterday. I don't know if you saw it, of two girls' football teams. So your girls would appreciate this. And one of the girls playing was wearing a hijab, and in a particularly exciting tackle, it slipped. And it was almost like she'd been injured. She cowered over herself straight away. And I get goosebumps thinking about it. Six of the opposition team clocked it straight away, gathered around her, and just stood there, literally making a shelter while she rearranged it so she could then carry on playing.
Oh, that's, I might be on my period. And I just thought that was magic.
It was just magic. It was really special.
And Nalufa thinks she's escaped this topic.
Oh, that's
she
so
thinks
lovely.
She's
what?
On safe
what
ground
have I done?
Well,
what have I done?
This is a generic question, actually.
Oh, really?
It's actually typed here that we ask all of our podcast interviewees. So, Nalufa, did you do anything naughty at school?
Did I do anything naughty at school?
Yes.
You
many
did confess
things.
In
yes.
the end, didn't you?
Yeah.
Okay, I need to know this.
Oh, I wasn't going to do this.
Are we looking at, like, top five, top three? I get the sense there's a lot you could pick from.
Let me begin.
There's a Hit 100 album for that one.
Let me begin.
Like, now 92.
Okay, so, well, firstly, more broadly, most new teachers will say, at the moment in particular, so I'm working with a lot of new teachers, will come to me in absolute tears and say, year nine, I can't cope. They hate my guts. Everything I do goes wrong. I spend hours planning these lessons and then they're horrible to me and it was my birthday.
As if they knew.
Most of my memories of Nalufa at her most boundary pushing stage.
That's such a nice way of putting it.
I know, I'm thankful.
And I do always say to those young teachers, those are the students that you will remember, and they're the ones who will cry when you leave the school.
Yeah.
And they're the ones, and this has been so throughout my career, who'll be running to you with the bunch of roses, the ones who made you cry night after night.
Oh God, Emma, I'm so sorry.
You did make me cry.
Oh,
I blanked it out. Right, so Nalufa and Fatima, sometimes found it a little bit hard to concentrate because the world was a very interesting place which required constant buzz of discussion.
Hang on. Is this that thing where you used to get your teacher to talk about anything else apart from verb conjugation so that you'd have the hour there?
That widened curriculum.
Hinterland.
Yeah.
Tell us about that time again.
See that, right? So she was the queen of that. She was the queen of that, queen of that.
But look where it's going now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. What German? She got a B. You got a B.
I got a B. I passed German.
I feel like you exceeded your expectations there of yourself.
We exceeded everybody's expectations.
She's trying to distract us again.
Nalufa and Fatima
felt that they had a human right to chew gum while they were working.
I'm not sure where this...
It's
in the UN Convention of the Child.
That's right.
Islamic faith. But it was about... So they had a human right to chew, and that the school rules against chewing weren't actually meant for them because they were special and they adored their teacher and they were really good at German and they were lovely people. So, you know, why would you be so harsh? Be so inhumane. So I do remember one day, and Nalufa denied this for about 18 years.
God,
when, great stability.
And what they would do is they would do that thing which students still do, and I say, I'm really old, don't try it, of just surreptitiously pretend not to be chewing.
Yeah.
Or there are many ways of chewing without a tooth.
I'm just demonstrating what that is.
Like. Yeah. Or the one where they bite off half of it and put it in the bin.
Yes. Oh, I remember.
Why would you do that?
Because you keep the other half. Put the chewing gum in the bin.
Oh, so this is the point where you're literally putting it in. It's like,
It was a sword I was willing to die on. Okay, yeah. I had chosen that as the front line. Okay,
that
was it. That was how I was going to rebel. That was how I was.
She called me a bitch.
I did. Oh, I did. That's a reflex.
Where's the sisterhood?
It was a reflex.
In front of everyone.
Oh yeah.
Was it a hiss?
It was a heartfelt hiss.
It was an impassioned... All right, I'll come clean on your podcast where I'm trying to sound intelligent.
Impassioned and heartfelt.
How did you feel?
Hurt to my core.
Did you do what I've seen other teachers do? Did you run off to the disabled loo, shut the door, have a little cry, then go, I can't go back out like this, and then go back to your lesson and everyone thinking, what's wrong with her? She's got really weird eyes. Did that happen?
I've got a hay fever.
Yes!
All done it.
I think I was actually genuinely staggered.
Yeah.
I certainly had plenty of times at Haverstock of going and snotting in the office. I can't breathe.
We call it our termly cry.
A certain young man you mentioned earlier picked up a chair and threw it across the classroom at a certain young lady whose name began with a K.
Oh my God.
Called her a certain word which began with a C. This was about my second week at Haverstock. That lesson.
I remember that.
I did end up in the office.
Yeah.
Literally with snot pouring all over the place.
Yeah.
So in Nalufa's defence then, the B word, whilst inappropriate.
Yes.
It was not the worst thing that happened.
She's seen Nalufa's face at this moment.
I concur. It's like Wimbledon. I feel like the referee in the middle. Umpire.
Okay, all right. We're going to just do this. Okay, we'll just do it. Fine.
It's cathartic, do it.
Emma, I did call you a bitch.
Yay!
Right.
And do you have something to say?
Emma, I'm really sorry that I called you a bitch.
And what have we learned from this?
Not to call your teachers bitches.
Thank you, Nicola.
Because they can come back and bite you 18 years later on a podcast.
And I will know you mean it by your future actions.
Yes. Ooh. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, please never tell me off.
God almighty. Yeah, exactly.
I will never be late for a podcast.
Which is why I denied it for 18 years.
I will never eat gum.
I don't think I had that teacher voice when I taught you. I think I was still quite a young teacher. I used to practice my teacher look, my glare. Yeah.
But I used to
do the disappointed thing rather than the glare.
No, but can I say, I've been shouted at many a time, especially maths, just the tone of that lesson for me is just shouting. But it was when the times when teaching was most effective, or when you were trying to discipline was most effective, was when you were disappointed in us.
Oh.
I to this day remember some of the times when I would, like, you know, you'd send me out. I got sent out of lessons. I got put in detention and put on report cards. I was an interesting student, but I wasn't a nice student by any stretch of the imagination. Yeah. No, but
Boundary pusher.
Yeah. But it was always going to be difficult. Like, so Emma would send me out of the class and I'd sit and seethe and think of all the ways to, like, I'm going to be worse and more terrible without my mum finding out, because she'd just be on the bloody phone to my mum. and I was just like plotting and she'd come out and she would be disappointed in me. And
it hurt.
Couldn't. And so that was what in the end, like, tempered my behavior, really. Like, just this idea of you being disappointed was enough for me. And I don't know what that relationship is, why we had that and why I didn't have it with other teachers, no, except Miss Knight. But I did. Like, I didn't want you to be sad. I didn't want you to, you know, in my household, we would get beaten. Like, if I'd said bitch to one of my sisters at home, my mum would grab my head and smack it against the wall. That's true. She would do that. And I'm happy to say it on air. But And I would be like, okay, cool, whatever. So physical violence or, like, being put in detention were never gonna really help my behavior or change my behavior. But the idea that you were so invested in me that you could be disappointed, I felt that.
I wonder, I don't know whether you found this, Clemmy, that was certainly a stage in my career where whilst I had Rav and we were in early days of Young Love, I didn't have my own children yet. I didn't... And you were my children. Oh, you know, I invested myself 100% to the point where I think I probably neglected Rav quite a lot.
I mean,
I could still recite that register. I was in my head practicing it on my way here. Yeah. You know, I remember every child in class. I remember,
totally agree with that. I still get asked that delightful question that women of a certain age in their 30s so love to answer, which is, why haven't you got kids
Where's
yet? Or
kids?
When are you having children?
Oh, is it
and
soon?
My answer to that is always, I have 520. And I genuinely do. I love and care for and celebrate and value and ponder upon for hours every single child in my care. And until, whether I do have children or not, they will always be my children. So yeah, I totally get that.
And that is exhausting. It's wonderful.
It must be.
But it's, and I wonder whether I have become more detached as I've been a teacher for longer. And I've just left a group of students who I absolutely adored. And with some of those, I had some of those relationships. But it was time to go, and I had to be quite ruthless. And I remember you were quite harsh with me. You said, are you telling me you're leaving the classroom? Yeah. Are you actually telling me that?
Yeah.
And I said, well, for a while, yes. But I don't feel bad, and I think I would have done 20 years ago.
At least because you're still impacting on people. And I think that kind of leads on to, I suppose, my question for you next is, obviously, you have a very successful career that doesn't involve being a teacher. But were you, having seen what you've seen and experienced what you've experienced, if you were to start influencing education policy, if you had an hour with the Secretary of State for Education, what would you say schools should be doing more of, or less of, or better at?
I would like to push back on the fact that I don't teach people. Have you ever tried to interview a politician?
Okay, yeah, good point.
I'm constantly teaching people.
Yeah.
Okay, what we're going to do now is we're going to do an interview. I know you've done this a million times, but you're going to have to speak in something other than stock phrases.
Oh, see, yeah. we're you're going to have to mentor us, because we've got some politicians
right.
on our list.
But anyway, off-podcast chat podcast. Coming. I think if I did have an hour with the Secretary of State for Education and they were amenable to the things I would say, it would be this, that I went through an education system. I am the product of an education system where money was basically held at us. I mean, we had
wow.
tons of money.
That's actually, can I just talk for a sec? That's really, really important. London in the early 2000s, I took 8 school trips. I don't think any child paid more than about 50 quid, and vast majority went completely for free on every single trip. We didn't have to worry about anything. Sorry, I interrupted you.
Not at all. When we would go on school trips, and we went on loads of them, like, I would go to Emma and be like, I can't afford £90 for the coach. And she'd be like, it's okay, I'll figure it out. What can you afford? And I'd go home and Mum would say £30. Yeah. And I would be on the coach.
Week in Berlin for 30 quid.
I did. Yeah. Nice. Yeah, deal with it. When I went to school in the early 2000s, that Blairite education. I mean, yeah. I think he literally said it in Parliament.
Yeah, he did.
All of that meant that we had access to spaces as poor people that we wouldn't have had access to. Like, I went on foreign trips. I was able to... We went to an infinite amount of museums and an infinite amount of excursions. Like, my world was expanded outwards at a voracious pace. Today... Like, my friend Sammy, who is a teacher, buys her kids colouring pens because otherwise...
Glue roll, glue.
They wouldn't have it.
Yeah.
So if I was to sit in front, and I would, and I should be the person to sit in front of the Minister of Education and say, this is what happens when you invest in education. I will pay your taxes. I will buy stuff in your local communities. I will reinvest everything I earn. And it's not, and that's a good thing because I am now... you should be proud that I'm a British citizen. I'm proud that I'm a British citizen, and it's because of the amount of money you invested in my education system. Wow. And now that you're not, the level of disaffected and failed young people coming out of schools from neighborhoods like mine, they are going to be a burden for you, a problem for you to solve. And that's disgusting because each one of them was a me. We had potential to be more. Mm. So,
and do you feel that potential goes? Like, if you leave school and you haven't reached or unleashed that potential, do you think it's then even harder to get there? Is it possible still, or is it game over?
No, Clem, there is no other structural institution that you are in for that length of time ever again in your life.
Right, so actually, one of the very few conversations we've never had is whether you would ever consider being a teacher. And if you were a teacher... What kind of teacher would you be? What would you teach?
Okay, I don't know if you know this, but when I finished my degree in English literature, I applied for the Institute of Education teaching scheme, the program. And I never found out if I got in or not because I instead got into the School of Journalism at City. And then I never finished that either because I went on to get a job. I got a job very quickly on Newsround to present Newsround. So... Yeah, well, you know, so I've always wondered what would have happened if I ever got the result. I'd never got the letter to know if I got in or not. I didn't get it because I was just moving. I just was just like, well, that's not happening. I'm going to go and learn journalism. And, oh, wow, I'm going to get a job immediately. So I never knew if I got into that class or not. But if I had done, I would have probably taught English literature. I don't have the skills or the acumen to teach a language, but if I could, and if it was like a crazy world where I could teach anything, I would teach confidence. At schools like mine.
What would that look like? Tell me what that would look like.
It would be a curriculum basically based around using the things that scare you the most. Like for me, my background terrifies me. Like I'm always petrified. Someone's going to ask me where I'm from and I'm going to say Afghan and they're going to do that thing that I sometimes get in America, which is just go, oh. You know, I'm like, well, got to come from somewhere.
Yeah, of course.
And I would teach my kids how to be proud of their unique selling points and how to use those things that they are terrified of, their hijab, or the fact that they might have a disability, or the fact that they might have an accent, so they've got a really strong Geordie or Liverpudlian accent, to their advantage. And I would just want them to understand that everything that you're getting in the school, in the curriculum and off the curriculum, are amazing opportunities and tools that you should that you're going to need in the wider world, and this class is an important one of those. So I would teach confidence
and I would pay you to come and teach that in my school.
Oh, thank you, Nilu, for you have been an absolute star.
I love that.
Wonderful. All right,
thank you so much.
Thank you.
In my pleasure.
Emma, I don't know about you, but that conversation's given me so much to go away and think about. The fact that she's only 2 years younger than me, and the difference in experience we've had in terms of living in this country, going through the education system, is just extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary.
Oh. Well, for me, it's that basic, you know, those nerves you get when you introduce someone you really like to someone else you really like,
yeah,
at a dinner or something, and you're really worried about whether they're going to get on. And yeah, just hearing you two chime off each other, and almost as Nalufa said, that two sides of the same coin and those, yeah, experiences. I have to say, yes, she confessed, but actually on a serious note, I have to say that, you know, life wasn't easy for Nalufa, and she didn't always find the learning easy either. You know, she wasn't, you might look at her now with her on the stage and doing all the amazing things she does, but she didn't find it easy. And I'm really proud of her.
Yeah.
I'm just really proud of her.
I could totally see that. And, you know, I know we like to challenge each other and push back on each other, but actually I think on behalf of everyone, I need to congratulate you. If Nalufa's an outcome of an Emma Kell education, it's a pretty strong offering.
I don't think I can accept those accolades. I think actually, I mean, her mum played such a significant role in that, and she did it herself. You know, we say to our students, we can give you,
yeah,
and we do, we pour so much into our students, and we say, well, I can give you all the advice in the world, but in the end, you have to take it away and do it yourself. And she's taken it away, and she's done it herself. And I'm sure she won't mind me saying, but you know, when I saw her 3 years ago, I was a little bit worried about her. She seemed a little bit tired, a little bit, but this time she seems to really grounded, and I love her worldview.
She was utterly inspiring. And I think, you know, for me, there's been a lot of talk recently about homeschool relationship and parenting, and how that can either be very, very toxic or hugely supportive and helpful. And again, you know, we've not got time now, sadly, but I'd love to pick your brains at some point over a glass of wine or so about how you developed such a strong relationship with her mum to make that such an effective partnership.
Well, I think we just ganged up on her. I think, you know, she started the little wayward thing in year nine, which really didn't go much further than gum chewing, I have to say, sadly. But we were this tour de force who just, yeah, sort of, depending on how you visualise it, either encircled her, or confronted her and said, uh-uh.
Yeah, consistency and honesty.
You're not going that way.
Yeah, and the other thing I really enjoyed hearing was her talking about her relationship with Fatima, and how, I don't know about you, Emma, but my best friends, we're all quite different in some ways and quite similar in other ways, but I don't think you get a much more different approach to being a Muslim than Fatima and Nalufa, and that was fascinating as well to hear the dynamics of that relationship.
Yeah, and Nalufa touched on this. I mean, what's sad about this, we could talk about all of this for weeks, but Nalufa touched on this, and I remember 9/11 and 7/7 happened during our time there. And I do remember our head teacher in a predominantly but not exclusively Muslim school, being leading with incredible courage and trusting us as teachers.
What did he do that was so effective? What can I steal with pride from is it Mr. Dowd?
John Dowd. John Dowd at the time used to quite scare me, because he was quite he was quite a straight-faced head teacher who was very much all about the coats and the uniform, which I never got at the time because we hadn't had a uniform and I didn't agree with the uniform, and I was a kind of young trendy teacher. And so John wasn't a kind of hearts and flowers head teacher at all. So what he did when 9/11 happened and 7/7 happened was he stood in front of us and he almost cried. And I remember Beslan as well, the Beslan massacre. And he stood up, and I'll never forget his words. He said, "Let us never forget what a precious resource we are working with." And that love, that integrity underneath the grey suit, that absolute passion that just permeated. But he presumably he had rehearsed it. Yeah. He'd sat up all night working out what to say. It didn't feel like that. And it felt as if we were his community. We were his staff, and they were our students. And he trusted us to go out and not give answers. Mm. Actually, that was the thing. You know, I wasn't, as a white middle-class girl from Buckinghamshire, going to go into my class of Muslim boys and say, "Well, it's all fine. Don't worry. Don't worry. No one, you know, you're not going to suffer from any kind of Islamophobia. It'll all be fine. Just let them talk. Yeah. It was one of the best. He was an amazing leader.
Well, I think that's, again, given us so much to go away and mull on. But thank you so much, again, for listening, everyone. If you want to pick up any of these themes on Twitter, as we so often do, don't forget we are, I'm at C Stewart SHS.
And I am at Those That Can.
And hashtag Clement M Podcast. Get involved in the conversation.
I think that's us done for now.
Make sure you tune into the next episode. Bye.
Bye.
The Clement M Podcast with Clemmy Stewart and Emma Kell. Special guest, Nalufa Hidayat. Produced by Rad Vadgama. The Clement M Podcast is a Those That Can production.